Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The University of Tulsa's Lectureship in Politics and Law takes place this evening, and it will feature an examination of the efficacy of nonviolent action, as Yale University political scientist Karuna Matana compares the two greatest practitioners of nonviolence, Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. Matana is a leading specialist on modern political theory. She chairs Yale's South Asian Studies and is the co-director of the International Conference for the Study of Political Thought. She's the author of Alibis of Empire, which looked at the origins and ending of imperialist ideology, and is currently working on a book about Gandhi's nonviolent philosophy. She'll be speaking on the practice of resistance, Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. The lecture takes place tonight at 7 at the University of Tulsa's Terrell Hall Auditorium and is free and open to the public. She joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Karuna Matana, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Your latest area of research has been looking at how Gandhi formulated his views of nonviolent social change and political change, and you're going to be speaking about him and King tonight. In the 21st century world, how effective is nonviolence as a strategy for effecting major political or social change?
The interesting thing is it's been about 100 years since Gandhi started his mass campaigns, and I think the success or the attraction have waxed and waned, but it really had a revival in the 1980s and 90s with the revolutions in Eastern Europe and Philippines. And some of the interesting thing that the social scientists now studying nonviolence have found is that it's surprisingly, I think you can show that it's been more effective than armed revolution for especially in transitions to democracy. And it seems to be becoming even more effective over time. But of course, I think that partially depends. And I think the reason they think it is the case is it's a form of protest which can bring out a lot of people. You know, armed resistance requires training and dedication, and it's very dangerous in a way that nonviolence isn't. So I think counterintuitively, it's actually become, I mean, it might be because armed resistance is just not as effective as it used to be 200 years ago, but it does seem to be the case that the power of nonviolence or nonviolent social change is with us. And so there's still a big question about why it works.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, for every Velvet Revolution in the Czech Republic and
right.
Slovakia, you have Tiananmen Square.
Yeah.
You know,
even Egypt, you would say.
Egypt,
Yeah. So I think it's right that it doesn't mean that it's, I don't think we can say it's always successful when it happens. There's still so many factors. But I think it's true that even violence or the use of force is actually even more unpredictable and probably less likely to produce positive results.
Well, you look in Sri Lanka, you know, where there was violence for decades, or in Northern Ireland, where there was violence for decades.
Right, and even the classic cases of Vietnam and Algeria, these wars, and even now I would say, you know, militarily, the U.S. won in some ways. They were a superior military power, but superior military power isn't going to give you a political victory. And in a way, I think theorists of nonviolence, that's partially what they are interested in, is that nonviolence is a way of producing political victories, of trying to build coalitions and showing people a different kind of power. And I think it's still the case that if you take Egypt, for example, and in general, effectiveness is nonviolence still, especially when it's about lots of people coming out, showing their disaffection for a government, that it's most powerful still as a negative. You know, it can really undermine the legitimacy of any regime. So even the most authoritarian regimes, and probably especially the most authoritarian regimes today, are very anxious. They know that their legitimacy is very weak. So they're very anxious when people come out in large numbers, because it doesn't take much to undermine their legitimacy. But of course, just getting rid of a power isn't enough to really
change things.
Change.
Well, you saw Egypt as a great example.
Yeah.
The Mubarak government fell.
Yeah.
Elections were held in which, and the military intervened.
Yeah.
And so the institutions were still very much in place.
Right. So I think that's what's really significant about King and Gandhi, because I think, as I said, over the course of the 20th century, nonviolence has become more attractive to a lot of its global movement. But it really changed in its meaning, I think, after King's assassination, where it did become more associated with getting large number of people out doing dramatic demonstrations, whereas King and Gandhi were really also interested not only in disruption, of breaking, you know, showing the government's undoing legitimacy of some kind. They also were interested in what they thought of as discipline, as showing constraint, and that might reach, you know, that might not produce continued cycles of enmity and anger, and actually try to protest in a way that you are trying to get more people interested in your movement. And, you know, as they would, the language they would use would be converting the enemy or just persuading people through the way you act. And I think they were very conscious that just yelling no or showing anger usually doesn't convince your opponent. They usually dig deep or dig down in their prejudice or their resistance. And so you have to do something to break the opponent's expectations and the public's expectations to have people see things in a new light.
Now, if I can throw out a more recent example, yeah. Occupy Wall Street, yeah. where that was an example of just saying no.
And I think they thought in the movements themselves, you have to show some creativity and construction. I mean, Gandhi's language was constructive nonviolence. So you have to build institutions. You have to practice new ways of show people how you would build these new kinds of institutions. That's a big task, and it's not easy. But I think that side of it is something that protest has lost sight of. And it's I think, especially in democracies, it's even more important. And it's something King more than Gandhi, I think, had to reckon with the fact that, you know, especially for African Americans, they couldn't just protest the government and leave, or like in India, you know, you could protest and the British were going to leave. You didn't have to reconcile with your enemy.
Yeah, you had to live with that enemy you had.
And I think that King was very conscious of. And so that means you have to protest. You have to criticize in a different way if your goal is not just to leave or kick people out, and you have to learn to live with your former enemy. Then it's a much more challenging and difficult way. But I think he thought that's why nonviolence was the only way, because you have to produce some conditions of friendship, some way of living together again.
Yeah, both of these people were martyred in one way or another.
Yes.
One, Gandhi, from basically his supporters feeling he had sold them out by making too many concessions to another faction within the movement, and that was the Muslim faction.
Yeah.
And in King's case, it was a reactionary from the other side.
Yeah. I think there is something really, I think both King and Gandhi, of course, they're both assassinated. I think in King's case, there is something also, you can tell, I think, in those late years in 68, that not only, you know, he's assassinated, it's a very interesting question of why they seem like such threats and to whom. What is it that they make people so uncomfortable about? And I think King, especially a lot of the late protests, you know, there were ways to try to undermine the movement was to make it violent, you know, try to disrupt it. And I think that also shows that even for very practical reasons, people knew that there was a power that he had and gained, and there was a power to people. The demonstration that the public learned from peaceful protest was dangerous to established powers in some form. But it is, I think it's still a shocking memory of the 20th century of how violent. And I think this also shows that I think it's also interesting because I think both of them, you know, people, they're often portrayed now as saintly figures in some way that had, you know, superhuman qualities. And in some ways they did. They were extraordinary moral forces. But I think people assume that nonviolence only works in liberal societies or places where people don't react violently. But I think in both those cases, you see, they came to nonviolence precisely in conditions of terror, what they feared of terrible violence. And it was because they understood that the conditions of violence and the potential for violence was so extreme that you had to come up with another method. It wasn't because they believed everyone was good. They did believe in people were naturally good, but they had to be taken back to their naturally good selves because the potential for domination, for pride, for ego, for expressing coercion or trying to coerce others was just too tempting in modern politics.
And when you think of India's struggle with Gandhi, I mean, this was a 30, 40-year struggle in which the British imperial government many times showed absolutely no mercy towards nonviolence. Yeah. I mean, in shooting down thousands of people in Amritsar and the like.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think we now retrospectively think that because the British didn't assassinate Gandhi, that it was a more peaceful adjustment. I mean, I think there's obviously a difference. There are lots of places where nonviolent movements and leaders have been just crushed, you know, Tiananmen or other places. So it's not that it's always going to work or these leaders will always survive. But I think when a movement, and of course, in both these cases, these figures, the movements did have trouble outlasting the leaders. But I think the challenge is, and some places now in the 80s and 90s, more recently in various parts of Eastern Europe, people have tried leaderless movements, and I think they can work. But the more leaderless a movement is, the more strict they have to be about the rules. You know, I mean, one of the things that's so striking about Gandhi and King is they had such strict rules about what you do when you come to a march, the kind of training you had to undergo, both in the Salt March, which was Gandhi's most famous movement, and King in Birmingham in 63, you had to sign a pledge. And then Gandhi had to take a vow to say exactly what you were going to do, how you were going to follow, you know, and they would give these rules about love and friendship. And it wasn't because they obviously knew they weren't convincing you in the moment, but it was just there so you reflect on what your purpose was
and what
there
you were about
march,
to do too,
what you're about to do, how you turn back to yourself when you feel anger coming or provocation, and you know who and other people will be there to guide you, so you'll have on the ground leaders who you know, so you can always follow their command. And that whole idea of how you perform an action in a very disciplined way with special rules and, you know, rules about how you dress, how you walk, and usually silence, and a whole sense of how you show calmness and you show dignity in your comportment.
Now, is that, have you found that to be the most effective strategy within nonviolence?
I think there are two ways. I think in some ways, in some ways, a lot of people coming together and being disruptive is effective in politics. That's just the way. It's always going to be the case. It's a show of force. It's nonviolent, but it's a show of force. I think Gandhi and King knew that. But I think they were looking for this other layer, and I think sometimes it's effective. I tend to think of it as more necessary. You know, even I think they even thought at some level, even if it doesn't work once, you try it again. And it's this other layer which they thought discipline did this other work. So I think in general, you know, when you think of a nonviolent protest, you often think of large crowds gathering together. But I think Gandhi and King were interested in these shows of dignity. And in its most extreme case, when they know that they're provoking violence or potentially confronting the police or confronting soldiers, and there is certainly a possibility. In those moments, you have to be especially disciplined. And I think one of the reasons they thought it would work is they did think, especially for the public, I think this makes sense, that naturally when you protest against a social order, those who benefit from the social order will feel it as a criticism, and they take it
personally.
Yeah, and they take it personally. So even if it's a threat to interest, people get angry. They're full of emotional responses. And Gandhi said very clearly, like, our, you know, often when we think we're reasoning, we're just justifying positions we already have, and we get angry. We feel resentful of people telling us we're wrong directly to our face. So he always thought that you had to kind of go indirectly. So you had to tell people it's not you, but the system you support. And the way you show that in protest is by not yelling at you directly, and by you not showing passion. The hope is that the other person's natural passions may also not get raised to the same level, and that somehow, and the public also, instead of seeing you as an anarchist or a criminal, I mean, Occupy had this problem that people saw them as anarchists and homeless and, you know, just having, and people, I think one of the insights that King, and he learned it from Reinhold Niebuhr partially in Gandhi, that people always think of protesters as criminals, anarchists, communists, or outside agitators or something. Mm-hmm. And so you had to disprove these assumptions to get people to just listen to what you were saying.
You know, I could see in Martin Luther King's case, he had the advent of mass media.
Yes. Yeah.
And access, a free press that could cover this.
Yeah.
Gandhi is working in the newspaper age.
Yes, yeah.
And, you know, a continent away to where public opinion, where his public opinion was trying to reach, which was the United Kingdom.
Right.
How does he do that? And does the fact that the United Kingdom was a liberal democracy play a role?
I think that does. I mean, that is a case in which some liberal, you know, nowadays it may not matter because there's social media that can translate. I think it is a really important question. Media is so central to the changing ways, the faces of nonviolence, too. So Gandhi was a completely media savvy in his own way.
He was working with newspaper reporters, William L. Shirer, and all sorts of people. Yeah,
and he himself was, his whole life he edited a weekly newspaper. It would be the equivalent. He would be an extreme blogger. He really wrote. He had a weekly newspaper from the time he was an activist in South Africa through his entire career in India. Multiple languages. Other people were editing, but he wrote most of the articles. A lot of them were question answer. It was his way of communicating with the public and the movement. So it would be updating people. But I do think in terms of England, he was also someone who thought, and this I think is interesting, even though both King and Gandhi, I think, were very aware of the media. The media mattered. But they thought, I think, that Gandhi, staged the Salt Satyagraha, was very happy to have international media. But he also was primarily interested. He didn't do a huge number of interviews. He didn't also want to be looked at as someone who was seeking media attention, because he didn't think the work was about media attention. It was both internally to show masses of people that they do have action and they can, in their own body, show resistance to a power, that you can embarrass the government, you can go to jail. All of these things are physical and material things that, the press are going to cover, will get media attention, but there is a kind of staging. But I think they didn't think it was only a theatrical performance, I think now there is and I think the more you have mass media and television and instantaneous media, especially in the 60s, you see people start turning towards more instantaneous forms of very audacious public acts that will get media attention.
Well, any international journalist knows that if you put up a camera in a conflicted area, all of a sudden you have a demonstration.
Right. And whereas, I think Gandhi and King were so interested in what the point of action was for those in the movement, how it changed their way of seeing themselves, that, King would say a proper protest or a march takes 30 days. These are campaigns that you show by doing them over and over again. And it's not just one day getting a ton of people out does nothing. In and of itself, it's not an important thing. So they're rare. Gandhi never organized a single day of protest. That would never be enough. It would be part of a very big campaign that was leading up to some sort of dramatic. And it was all the year-long work before it that mattered. But I think the problem is when the means or the message, when that ends up being how you orient the protest instead of thinking about what it's trying to do on its own terms.
My guest today is Karuna Mathana. She's an associate professor of political science at Yale University and the chair of the South Asian Studies there. She'll be giving the University of Tulsa's lectureship on politics and law tonight at 7 o'clock at Terrell Hall Auditorium on the practice of nonviolence, Gandhi and Martin Luther King, looking at both of those two. And she's actually working on a book, I believe, on Gandhi's political thought and how he came to nonviolence. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, we're talking about this. It's not enough to do, say, a single day march on Washington. It's a campaign. And when I'm thinking of leaders today, I'm really thinking of somebody like William Barber in North Carolina, who does a weekly sort of occupation of the North Carolina State Capitol to make a difference and change some of the social views of that legislature. Mm-hmm. Is that one of the most effective strategies?
This is a harder. I think in some ways, it seems to me the most effective activism we've seen in America. Some of it is Black Lives Matter, which you can come back to, and I think the climate change movement, and climate change especially, I think, has found this way to find these local campaigns, pipelines, and investment campaigns, to find like a local link that you are campaigning against and do it over time, and then sit at the Capitol. But I think you have to do both sitting at the Capitol and spreading out to these other individual.
Yeah. As you think of some of the strategies used in civil rights in America and in ending British rule in India, it's a lot of times it's bringing laser-like focus to some of the absurdities.
Yes.
You mentioned the Salt March several times. Fact that a country halfway around the world controls all the means of salt in a place where there's no refrigeration, and salt is basically the elixir of life, it preserves food. Or in Montgomery, where arbitrarily a person can ride in the front of the bus or the back of the bus.
Right.
That would be a key strategy.
Yeah, I do think there's a link with Black Lives Matter up to a point, in the sense that I think all protest, but especially nonviolent protest, works by being really creative and innovative in its symbolic language, you know. So I think, yeah, the Salt March was a really extraordinary moment where, yeah, most people, Gandhi, you know, he himself gave a very dramatic account of how, you know, he had to think in silence. He was thinking for a long. He was always, you know, he always protested against salt. It was always the salt monopoly. He always mentioned it as this critical thing. But no one of the Congress leadership, they all thought this was a very unusual and strange request.
It's not, I think it's a difference between Western and his the home, because, I mean, you know, by that time, nobody thought of in Western democracies of salt as being this sort of essential food item.
Right. But I think the thing that was really important to him was finding something unusual that would bring people together in unusual ways. So there isn't, you know, if you do something more traditional, like a strike, you know, a worker strike against a factory, you have a kind of sense of the rich versus the poor. But here he thought you have to find, especially for India at that moment, finding a kind of thing that brings all the classes together. And especially for him, it was important that it should be some symbol that's really about the majority or the poor of India. You know, it has to be something that symbolizes an offense to someone's very basic nature that we all could relate to. So I think the equivalent sometimes, I think, in the civil rights movement was some of the lunch counter sit-ins or something that just seems so basic. And also, I think in both King and Gandhi, and King, especially in Birmingham, learned from the lunch counter sit-ins, which were led by students, of also using children in these marches. I mean, it was very frowned upon. It was so controversial. But it was something about the fact that children were asking for access in Birmingham to parks. Parks were closed. So a series of public parks had been desegregated, and they were, instead of desegregated, the city just closed them. So this was part of, and he was trying to, you know, the children were going to come to show that this is absurd, you know, this kind of just this dysfunction of basic human capacity of decency. So I think that that creativity of finding this symbols that can really change people's expectations matter.
Earlier you were talking about how we view King and Gandhi today as almost saintly figures, of being almost, in Gandhi's case, a religious mystic.
Yes.
King, a very much religion at the heart of the nonviolence movement. What role does religion play for the average person participating in a nonviolent movement? Because if you're looking at self-sacrifice, you figure if you sacrifice yourself in this struggle, there's going to be a reward somewhere, and then maybe in the next world or in the afterlife.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, of course, it was in America in particular, and for King, it was also the church was such a central space of organizing that was, not controlled by civil powers or the white state, or, you know, so it was something about the black church had this independence in it, so it could, there was a really important organizational feature. That wasn't the case in India, because Gandhi was building his own organization. He certainly wasn't relying on religious organizations.
And for the most part, it was multi-religious.
Exactly. Yeah. But I think you're right. So there is something really interesting and important that nonviolence, in its entire history, the first people who were interested in it were religious figures. And in fact, you know, the connection between Gandhi to the African-American movement and the civil rights movement, one of the tracks were through ministers, you know, the pacifist Fellowship of Reconciliation, and then a whole series of African-American theologians and religious thinkers who first became interested in Gandhi. And so I think there was something they recognized in the language of the self, the dignity of the self in action. One of the things, again, that Reinhold Niebuhr said, which I think is right, and you sort of alluded to it, that, you know, religious, I think it's also less about sacrifice as much as religion teaches us, he thought, to think about constraints and limits. And also, it's a, you know, religious practice is always about turning inward and rethinking our motivations and learning how to figure out, limitations and not just be getting what you want all the time. So he thought
bubbling
those,
id.
Yeah, so I think he thought some of those virtues that religion teaches are really important for doing nonviolence, you know. So it's not, I think it's not just that you believe in an afterlife, but that you connect to yourself or to the soul in a perfect...
Since there's something bigger than you.
Yeah. And I think that was important for Gandhi too, that he thought that religion meant just the sense that you had a higher goal or something bigger that you could see yourself working towards. I mean, sacrifice, I think, is a very complicated question because, I mean, on the one hand, Gandhi always says he was worried sometimes, and this is an interesting thing about the early 20th century, there were a lot of people who worried that sometimes we too easily will sacrifice. You know, there are a lot of movements. We know revolutionary movements that people are sometimes really willing to give up their lives for very bad causes. And so he was also worried about a kind of egoism that comes from willing to give up things or giving up your life or doing drastic action just for the sake of drastic action. So I think he also wanted to figure out a way. So in some sense, he would say, you know, everyone who works in an army understands sacrifice. But the sacrifice that's important is not wanting, getting over, you know, wanting, you know, showing strength by being able to kill someone, but it's by overcoming the fear of death, but in a way that isn't egoistic or isn't about being dramatic in some form. But I think it's a very, for Gandhi, it's a pretty complicated question because he's both believes in the right sacrifice, but also scared of people who kind of love the idea of sacrifice too much.
So he's not looking to martyrs from the past as the model for nonviolence.
Yeah, I mean, he has a very particular way. He does celebrate martyrs of in the Hindu religion and others, like stories of martyrdom.
Or even, quoting, you know, things from Jesus and things like that from
Absolutely.
All religions. Yeah.
But he has, I think one of the phrases that he uses, and other scholars have really written beautifully on this, he uses this phrase where he says, you know, the gift, he's very interested in fear and overcoming fear. And in Sanskrit and in Hindu ethics, the term is abeya, which is actually a negative term. It means removal of fear, you know, so it's not fearless. It's like the removal of fear. And he said, you know, the greatest thing that the nonviolent soldier does is give the gift of fearlessness, which is one word, abedan. So that's the difference between a soldier. The soldier also is willing, is sacrificial, is willing, has overcome fear. But he also, the soldier is a figure, especially with a weapon, is someone that people fear, and they might be peaceful because of fear. But the nonviolent soldier, when they sacrifice or show courage, they remove fear in others, and that's a very different kind. So if you stand before someone who's protecting, who's a sign of protection, but also takes away your fear, that's the ideal and the difference, and very hard and really only in extraordinary circumstances you can imagine this kind of courage and its dramatic effect. Yeah.
Well, lots of food for thought there. Karuna Mathana, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Karuna Mathana is an associate professor of political science at Yale University and the chair of their South Asian studies. She'll be giving the University of Tulsa's lectureship in politics and law tonight at 7 o'clock at Tyrrell Hall Auditorium on the practice of nonviolence, Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. The lecture is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.